for some reason, we were always put in the same bed. And oddly, we always would end up kind of our bodies slammed against each other in the night. It was very innocent, and nothing was ever said in the daylight, in the harsh light of reality, I suppose. That feeling of coming apart, maybe part of coming of age. That feeling of coming apart, maybe part of coming of age. It was the first time that I was really around a lot of other gay guys. I knew they were gay because it was the first time I sensed a gaydar in me. But I was so terrified that in no way did I ever reach out to them. It started to happen, though, that I knew they were reaching out to each other. And I felt, and I feel, an incredible sense of cowardice now that these guys were able to in some way connect. And I was such, I don't know, I think a coward. So still wrapped up in my own idea that I needed to pass, that I was still playing the good boy to such a degree that I did not take the opportunity to at least connect. I wanted the leaders to love me. I wanted still to be the best little boy. I was still playing that idiotic game. And yet, one of my best friends, he fell in love with a guy from South America in our cast, and it ended up kind of blowing apart, and they were forcibly separated in a way that was shaming and humiliating. And because they were not caught in a sexually compromised situation, they could not be sent home. But the very fact of their love, their deep obvious friendship, and the fact that they had tried to rig the system so that they could be roomed together more than was random. When management found out about that, they hit the roof, and they never were able to room together again, which, you know, okay, fine, no big deal, but it was, these guys were beaten down to within an inch of their life, basically in front of the whole cast. Everyone knew about it. It was never directly spoken about, though. It was this sick, underground, dirty shaming. Every day, people the time you meet, every day, just walking down the street, every day, you old, not even trying to leave. We lionize heroes in this culture, we lionize firefighters and soldiers and people who do acts of physical bravery, and that's fine. Whatever. You want to call that a hero? That's fine. Heroes are people who take profound risks. So many people project on gay people that we're weak, you know? Show me someone who's come out of the closet, and I'm going to show you someone who's braver than just about anyone on earth.
Cruz is one of several former Up With People cast members featured in the new documentary Smile Till It Hurts, playing at film festivals around the U.S. He now lives in Northern California and with his husband Jack runs the San Francisco-based company Nancy Boy. These days he smiles when he feels like it and only sings in the shower. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Up with people. You meet him wherever you go.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Chris Coleman, Michael LeBeau, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Up With People performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is underwritten in part by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thank Thanks for listening. I'm KUOI Moscow, Idaho, Arrow FM, Masterton, New Zealand, WRIR Richmond, Virginia, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. For the 1,116th time, please stay tuned.
This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk in Eastern Connecticut, 88.7 FM. We hope you'll stay tuned for Counterpoint coming up next. But right now we do have an announcement of an upcoming benefit concert event for this radio station. So take a listen and we'll be back with Counterpoint in just a few moments. On Sunday, August 30th, WPKN returns to the Martha Clara Vineyards in Riverhead, New York for a benefit concert for WPKN. The show starts at 12 noon and goes on until 6 in the evening with Movement, The Point, Reckoning, and The Electrics. This is a great chance to catch some of Long Island's favorite bands all in one place. Martha Clara Vineyards is at 6025 Sound Avenue in Riverhead, New York. Admission is $10 at the door. Kids 12 and under are free. That's Sunday, August 30th at 12 noon at Martha Clara Vineyards. For more information, go to MarthaClaraVineyards.com or visit us at WPKN.org. We hope to see you there.
Can you dig it? When you're popping out the sun, can you dig it? And you're loving everyone, can you dig it? And you're having so much fun, can you dig it?
So that's coming up at Martha Clara Vineyards, Sunday, August 30th. Big party out there on Long Island. Benefit for this radio station. For more information, call us up at 203-331-9756 or go to our website, WPKN.org. WPKN.org. Right now, we'll invite you to stay tuned for a Counterpoint coming right up next. Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, here Monday evenings between 8 and 10 p.m. here on WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk, New York. And with us tonight will be Scott Horden adjunct professor at Columbia University School of Law and contributing editor to Harper's Magazine. We're going to be talking about two topics. We'll be having him discuss indications that Barack Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder may launch some limited version of an investigation into U.S. torture under the Bush administration, and also some new revelations about former Bush administration political advisor Karl Rove's involvement in the firing of U.S. attorneys after the conclusion of Bush's first term. And a little later tonight, we'll be hearing from Jake DiLiberto. He's a founding member of the group Vets for Rethinking Afghanistan. We're going to be looking at the escalation of the war in Afghanistan under Barack Obama and the upcoming elections there on August 20th. We'll also be speaking with Joe Dinkins, and he is somebody who works over at the Connecticut Working Families Party. We'll be talking about the state budget crisis and some of the other work of this coalition-supported political party, really a fusion political party, the Connecticut Working Families Party. But we do begin our program tonight, and we're very honored to have back with us after a long absence, Chip Berlay. He's a senior analyst with the group Political Research Associates. He's the author of the book Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort, and also author of the recent report titled Toxic to Democracy, Conspiracy Theories, Demonization, and Scapegoating. Chip Berlay, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's been a while since we've talked. We used to talk more regularly, but we've got no shortage of things to talk about, so I hope you'll be a more frequent guest in the future.
Thank you.
We wanted to talk about the rise of these right-wing protests, very effective protests at the healthcare town hall meetings that have been conducted by primarily Democratic legislators around the country. And, of course, along with that, a very sophisticated and coordinated disinformation campaign talking about the imposition of death panels for senior citizens, declarations that there will be mandatory abortions of handicapped fetuses and severe rationing of medical care, a socialization of our healthcare system in this country, just many myths and lies deliberately placed in there, I think, to confuse people. Of course, you can't generalize, but I wanted to get your take on the kinds of groups and individuals which are being drawn into the protests at these town hall meetings.
Well, it's very clear that you have a number of different forces, elite forces, that are sending out all kinds of alarmist messages to a very large audience that includes corporations and right-wing media and right-wing politicians and all sorts of demagogues who really want to oppose Obama on every possible level. I think they saw that Sotomayor was going to get seated at the Supreme Court, and so this was the next big opportunity. Healthcare is an issue that really pushes a lot of buttons with people, so I think that's part of it. Partly it's the collapsed economy for a lot of folks. Partly it's just a whole lot of white people have a lot of anxiety about a president who's a black man. I think it all sort of fits together. And so you have to draw a distinction between the fact that a lot of this information that's being sent out into the population is contrived and it is misinformation from the fact that these are real people. These are neighbors. These are, in some cases, family members. They're angry. They're anxious. And they have every right to show up at a town meeting and ask tough questions. What they don't have a right to do is intentionally disrupt and stop other people from talking or asking questions or become a mob. And I think that that's the issue. And I'm not saying that, you know, militant protests should never be allowed. I've been part of them myself. But there's something very special about preventing an elected official from getting questions from an audience. And I think that's what's been happening. And it's been very scary for a lot of people to show up at these meetings and have folks absolutely over the top about claims that they're going to kill grandma and that since FDR built big government and big government is socialism and national socialism is Nazism, then Obama is Hitler. And you go, phew, whoa, wait a minute, stop. And somebody just sent me on the internet a picture of Obama with Hitler's haircut and mustache. I mean, So there's a lot of things going on. It's not okay for liberal elites in Washington to say these are wing nuts and they have no right to speak at these meetings, when, of course, in a democracy, everyone has a right to speak at these meetings. So we have a Democratic Party that has coasted on, you know, inside the Beltway spinmeisters for so long, it's forgotten how to talk to an audience out in the real world. And that's a shame. Obama, I think, has modeled really good behavior at the meetings that he's spoken at, and he's taken the questions very seriously, even the tough ones. But it's scary to see democracy in the state that it's in. So I wear a couple hats. I wear a hat as a person who watches the right, saying right-wing populism is always dangerous. It almost always blames people of color or immigrants or other minorities or oppressed peoples, with scapegoating and demonization and these apocalyptic claims. But wearing my I Like Democracy hat, I'm thinking the Democrats are doing a pretty lousy job of talking to people about policy, and as soon as somebody shouts boo, they run into the corner and say, okay, no single payer, no government option, what do you want us to do? So, I mean, that's pathetic. Both sides are pathetic.
As you say, it looks like there are indications that Barack Obama's administration may be pulling back on the public option.
Yep.
To have a public health care plan to compete with the private insurers. And I think many people on the progressive left will look at that and do look at that as a real surrender, really early on in this whole debate. And they really seem to have caved in to the point where they were trying to compromise with the Republicans, who obviously weren't in the mood to compromise on anything and whose votes really weren't necessary, to the point where any real health care reform looks like a distant mirage at this point. But Chip, I wanted to ask you about the violence, because there have been some instances where protesters have showed up with posters and rhetoric calling for violence in subtle and not-so-subtle ways. There was a man in New Hampshire wearing a sidearm when he came to a town hall meeting that President Obama spoke at. What is the potential for violence being sort of part of the environment here in the call to militant opposition against Barack Obama and his quote-unquote socialist agenda?
Well, again, right-wing populism is based on resentment and anxiety. It's often racist and anti-immigrant, and it often, if it continues to grow in a society, spins off violence. But let me point out that since Obama was elected, there have been 9 murders connected to white supremacist ideology, 9, including attacks on Jewish institutions, on people of color in Massachusetts, on immigrant family in the Southwest, police officers in Pittsburgh. It's really astonishing that people haven't woken up to the fact that the violence is already occurring.
But would you say that some of the rhetoric being used here at these town hall meetings and by the groups who are organizing them, either transparently or behind the scenes, that they're playing with fire in terms of getting people riled up? And I would include in that group some of these right-wing talk show hosts who, talk about Nazism and Hitler's and concentration camps and the like. Will that arouse some fringe elements to take up arms and commit violence, do you think?
Oh, sure, I'm agreeing with you 100%, and I'm saying it's already happened, and in fact, if you study the rise of the militia movement in the 1990s, which is why Matthew Ann Lyons and I first wrote Right-Wing Populism in America, it's the same feeling right now when the militias were just spinning off in the mid-90s, early 90s. Already there are indications that there are people who are storing arms and engaging in activities very similar to the militia movement. The Southern Poverty Law Center calls it Militia 2.0, and other watchdog groups across the political spectrum have been watching this for some time. So, yes, it's a very dangerous moment, and in case you ask, the fact is, all fascist movements start out as right-wing populist movements, but not all right-wing populist movements evolve into fascism. But, even when most right-wing populist movements never become a true neo-fascist movement, they create tremendous damage in the society, not just in terms of killing people, which happens, but it completely sours the political discourse in the society, and it sets aside any kind of serious debate and struggle over actual policy and actual issue. And there's a period of just, national people take leave of the kind of rational and serial logic required to actually find a compromise in a tough political struggle.
We're speaking with Chip Verley, senior analyst with the group Political Research Associates, and he's author of the recent report titled Toxic to Democracy, Conspiracy Theories, Demonization, and Scapegoating here on Counterpoint. Chip, I wanted to ask you about the McCain-Palin campaign. During the 2008 presidential election campaign, we saw some real ugly politics developing at the rallies of Senator John McCain and his running mate Sarah Palin, where there'd be shouts of "kill him" or, you know, "he's an Arab," just some wild and crazy accusations. Some that McCain responded to constructively, and others he just let go by. There was also the clarion call of Barack Obama was a socialist, and that somehow his agenda was to impose on this country a kind of Soviet agenda.
Right.
Now, that seems to have carried over since the campaign, because that's the theme of many opponents of health care reform.
That's correct.
And I wonder, you know, in terms of mainstream politics, is this something new? Because I don't recall seeing this kind of language being used, you know, in contemporary history. I think you'd have to go back to the McCarthy era to see it, the kind of tone of the McCain campaign now carried over to the current politics. You know, the language is just so over the top. What do you think?
Well, you know, I spend my day reading right-wing literature, so I can tell you bad news is that it's very typical of a certain two sectors of the right, typified by the John Birch Society, which was formed in late 1959 and grew to support the Goldwater campaign in 64, and very much the same rhetoric from the right during the Goldwater campaign, that the Democrats wanted socialized government, big government. And there's two roots to that. One is this kind of ultra-libertarian view that was developed in the 1920s and 1930s by Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek and a guy named Flynn, who, and they wrote these tracts and studies where they said big government is a form of collectivism. It's the same whether it's on the right or the left. Therefore, FDR and Mussolini are developing the same, essentially, you know, big government policies of collectivism. And over time, this got transmuted in the popular right wing to the idea that FDR was just similar to Hitler, that socialism and national socialism are twins, and that national socialism is a form of collectivism, just like FDR's administration to get us out of the Depression was collectivism, and it's all the same thing. Now, what happens is at the same time, the Christian right over a period of many decades developed a conspiracy theory about in the end times, which they have a particular reading in the book of Revelation, where they believe that a major political figure emerges right before Jesus is scheduled to arrive and basically tries to build a one-world government, a collectivist government. And so over the years, starting many, many decades ago, they began to write tracts about how America was being betrayed to this collectivist satanic plot. And I know that sounds really strange, but if you read the Left Behind series, as 70 million books have been sold in that series, you know, and people in the Christian right hear this on a daily basis, they believe that big government is the first step towards tyranny, where Christians will be repressed, and there will be tyranny, and it is all on behalf of the devil, literally, a satanic movement. So since you have had these two arguments being put forward now for 50, 60, 70 years, there are tens of millions of people out in this country who have heard this around the dinner table or reading a magazine or listening to the radio. So it really pushes a button. And so this is something that has sort of been beneath the radar of most people who, you know, actually read scholarship on these subjects, but most Americans don't, and they really base their ideas on this popular media milieu in which very few of us pay attention.
Chip Verley, to what extent do you think a lot of these people showing up with protest signs and shouting down speakers at these town meetings are real adherents to this this agenda of the Republican Party or extreme right-wing groups who view Barack Obama as a socialist are anti-Social Security, anti-Medicare, anti-Food and Drug Administration to make sure our food and drugs are safe, anti-FAA to keep the planes from crashing, anti-police, anti-fire department, anti-universal education, anti-public libraries. I mean, if you carry to an extreme what these people believe in terms of their anti-government platform, you'd have to abolish all forms of just basic town, city, state, and federal government.
Well, to a certain extent, this is a worldview driven by anxiety and emotion rather than logic and a kind of political ideology. There are very few pure libertarians who want to simply do away with all government. And you find them on both the left and the right, and they believe in a kind of decentralized society. And they're at least consistent. We're not talking about either the mainstream of Christianity or the mainstream of conservative libertarian thinking. We're talking about a group of people who are just so angry and so fed up that they see elites, they feel squeezed from above and below. They think that there are secret elites up above, and it doesn't matter whether they're Republican and Democrat, and there's secret elites down below secret parasites and subversives down below, and they're the heroic producing middle class, and they're beleaguered by these traitors above and traitors below. And that's why you get slogans like throw the bums out, or abolish the taxes, or none of it makes sense logically, but they're just fed up. And too often, people on the left see that as somehow a kind of populism that is progressive, and they get behind these movements of throw the bums out, or there's no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. When, for poor people, there is a real difference between the Democrats and the Republicans in terms of being able to feed your family, and that may not be much, but you got to be pretty privileged to say it makes no difference whether someone is malnourished or not. So you have this tradition in America, and as so many people on the left have drifted away from any kind of structured or systemic or institutional understanding of power, they've bought into these kinds of, the elites, the secret elites run everything, we have to throw them out, they're behind 9/11, they're behind, everything that ever has happened bad, all the assassinations and probably a few earthquakes, and it's become a magical thinking. And so we're seeing now more people on the right getting involved in this, but far too long, too many people on the left have been saying some of the same things.
But it is true, is it not, that the big pharmaceutical companies, the healthcare industry, and others who don't want to see healthcare reform, they're funding Democrats and Republicans to oppose some dramatic changes in this very broken system. The Blue Dog Democrats have seen a spike in their contributions from these big companies who want to stop healthcare reform. So there is a certain amount of truth that you do have a system that prevents change because you've got money that has commands so much power and influence on Capitol Hill where things would have to change first.
Yeah, but you said the magic word. There's a system. It's called corporate capitalism. It's called, corporate interests. It's called globalization on behalf of corporations. It's got names, and it's systemic and institutional, and if you throw the bums out, whatever that means, you're just going to rotate a handful of people around, and you're not changing the system at all. So radicalism, when you talk about political radicalism, you're talking about change at the root. That's what it means. And so this populist anti-elitism goes nowhere, and when it's blunted, when it doesn't go anywhere, which is always true because it has no place to go, because it's all emotion and all anxiety, it turns on the people that can be reached, and that's usually people of color, immigrants, oppressed minorities, anyone that this middle class, largely white movement can get to when it shakes its fist up above it as this picture of a handful of bad secret elites who are screwing everything up. But then they stomp on the people below them, and that's ugly. So yes, absolutely. Are there systems and structures as institutions of elite power that are unfair and need to be changed? Absolutely. I'm with you on that. But, it's not 10 guys drinking bourbon in a basement on Wall Street.
Right. It's more like maybe 1,500 guys, right?
Well, sure. But it's And if you sent them all to an obscure island and fed them, you know, tapioca for 10 years, another 1,500 move in. So it's
right.
Not the people.
It's a system.
Getting rid of the people doesn't change anything. Getting rid of systems and replacing them with systems that are more equitable and fair and more democratic, that is change.
Well, that's well put. Thank you, Chip. And I wanted to ask you, you had mentioned before the important element of racism, the undercurrents of racism. How important is the historical and endemic racism in this country to what we've seen develop around these healthcare town hall meeting protests?
I think a lot of the anxiety, and I do think it's unconscious to a large extent, even when it's obvious to people who study it. I think a lot of the anxiety and the sense of being buffeted around by change that they can't understand, it can be attributed to not only changing racial and gender power relationships in America, but the fact that we now have a black man as president. And while most people in America accepted that without going into the streets, a few people have gone into the streets. There, as I say, there have been 9 murders tied to white supremacist ideology. So people sucked it up and said, okay, but then we didn't have the conversation we needed to have, which is there's unfinished business, there's unfinished racial disparity, there's unfinished white supremacy, there's unfinished tasks that have to be talked about. And, you know, some people have started those conversations, but there needs to be a national conversation. And I'm certainly not the only person to have pointed out that so much of the anger and anxiety that you see in these town meetings, I think, is a subconscious fear that people have been displaced, white people have been displaced, that they no longer have the power and privilege that they thought they had a right to. And to some extent, that's true. And there has been some tiny equalization of power and privilege. And they think they're going to lose more, and that might be true too. But the solution isn't to pretend it's not happening. There is a changing demographic in the United States. There are changing power relationships along the lines of race and gender. And if we pretend that, you know, everything's fine, we're like putting a pressure cooker on the stove and blocking the escape valve. You know, we're just making some white people in America feeling more and more stressed out. And since they can't stand up and say what they really think, which is, I don't know what on earth is happening in America that elects a black man, they project it and turn it. They turn it in a different direction and pick up a scapegoat and vent their anxiety and anger at the scapegoat, in this case, the healthcare system.
Chip, I just wanted to ask you this before we say goodnight, and that is, if you were to advise those citizens and organizations that are in favor of healthcare reform, whether they be Democrats or grassroots activists, what would you tell them to do in order to counter the misinformation and the success of these town hall meeting protests that have certainly had a willing partner in the corporate media, which, you know, focuses on conflict with very little substance to counter the lies and the crude disinformation tactics?
Well, I think people need to find a backbone. It'd be nice if there was leadership from the Democratic Party, but apparently, you know, that isn't forthcoming. So everybody who supports fair health care and a revised health care system that really looks to the treatment of illness and then prevention of illness for all people in America, let's get up off our butts and do something. Let's show up at these remaining meetings. Let's call our elected officials. Let's talk to our neighbors, our coworkers. It's up to us to raise some hell. What's the matter with us? We're being out-organized by a handful of you know, right-wing demagogues, and there are people in our towns and neighborhoods who are going off with this tremendous anxiety and anger, and we can play a role in standing up and saying, I know you're angry, you have a right to ask questions, but chill out. Stop disrupting the meeting. People have a right to participate, but they don't have a right to be a mob. Let's talk this over. Let's confront the bad information. It's the rebut, rebuke, reaffirm, the 3 R's. You rebut the bad information, you rebuke the people who supplied the information, and then you reaffirm what you stand for. This is basic organizing. I don't know what the Democrats' playbook is, but it certainly isn't what kind of organizing that the labor unions and the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the gay and lesbian rights movement did so well. I don't know why they've given up on organizing real people in real places.
Well, the Democrats are on vacation this month. Maybe that's the problem.
Yep.
Chip, Would you suggest that President Obama take a different tack, become more aggressive in countering the lies, the deliberate lies? Is he not using his office, the very powerful office he occupies, to the full extent he should to push this agenda?
Well, I think his the way he's run the meetings where he's been the participant, he's been modeled very good behavior. And I think we've got to give him credit for that. I think what we have is a group of centrist Democrats who flooded into Washington after the Obama election, and they're like barnacles on the ship of state, and I think we should scrape them off. So I'm blaming the Democratic Party. I'm blaming groups like the Democratic Leadership Conference. I'm blaming every overpaid liberal elite spin doctor in America. They should get a real job and get out of the Beltway and start really pushing back. You want a policy? Push it. You don't go into a negotiation with a compromise already in your hand. That's idiotic. I don't know what these people are studying when it comes to organizing, but it's pretty pathetic.
Well, that was a good summation of this problem, Chip. I appreciate all the work you do at Political Research Associates, and maybe you could just tell our listeners some of the material they can find on the website, and certainly list the website address there or anywhere else you think people can get some good analysis of what's going on.
Well, definitely publiceye.org is our website. We have a lot of stuff on right-wing populism, and it's right on the front page, some of the links. I think there are a number of labor unions and health groups that are organizing. Ralph Nies is going to be on some of the Sunday programs. There are lots of good people who are involved in this, and it doesn't take a lot of work to try and find them. They're in your local community. Get involved, and if you can't find a group, talk to your neighbors and go to that next meeting.
Yeah, the Southern Poverty Law Center being one of them, Ralph Nies, and some of the other, Mark Potok and the other guys.
No, Ralph Nies is with a healthcare coalition who's pushing a much more government-related healthcare reform.
Okay.
Mark Potok is at the Southern Poverty Law Center. They have an excellent report out on the militia movement sort of reforming in the current period.
All right. Well, Chip, thank you. Chip, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
You bet.
And we'll call you back when we can to get you to give us an update. Thanks.
Yeah, it's the National Coalition on Healthcare is what you should look. Contact them.
National Coalition on Healthcare. Okay.
Yep.
Take care, Chip. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Chip Berlay, Senior Analyst with Group Political Research Associates. That's publiceye.org. And you can look on that website for his recent report titled Toxic to Democracy, Conspiracy Theories, Demonization, and Scapegoating. This is WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk, New York. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint. Go to our website, WPKN.org, to check out the schedule, how you can volunteer and make a secure online contribution. Also, some of the interviews featured on this program, live on Monday nights, can also be heard in edited form on our Between the Lines Radio News Magazine website. That's btlonline.org, btlonline.org, and you can subscribe to weekly program summaries, interview transcripts, and podcasts that are available 24/7 from the current to archive programs from years ago. That's btlonline.org. You can take a little musical break and be back in just a moment to discuss Karl Rove's role in the firing of U.S. attorneys in a torture probe that may be coming out of the White House. Stay tuned. Walkers and bombs.